Shall we turn to Luke's Gospel, chapter 7? The fame of Jesus is growing. Several times we read in Luke's Gospel how that the reports of Jesus were spreading around, the rumors of him were spreading. And so as we come to the 17th verse, and this report about him went throughout all Judea and the surrounding regions. The word report there in the Greek is logos, this word of him. You remember in our last lesson what word it is. Jesus came to the city of Nain with a great multitude of people, large crowd following him, his disciples and a large crowd. As they came to the city of Nain, coming out of the gates of the city was another large crowd. Opposite kind of feelings within the crowds. The crowd that was coming out of the gate was a funeral procession. A young man, the only son of a widow, had died, was being carried in an open coffin to his burial place. The wailing, the mourning of the crowd coming out of the gate, and the excitement and the happiness of the crowd coming in because they had just seen Jesus do some marvelous things down at Capernaum as far as healings. One crowd is animated, excited, happy. The other crowd is sad, dejected. Two opposing crowds meeting at the gate. The widow, the mother of the boy, is weeping, and Jesus goes over to her and he says, "Woman, don't weep." And then he went over to the open coffin and did something that was ceremonially unlawful to do. He touched the coffin. You didn't touch the dead. You didn't touch anything that belonged to the dead that made you unclean. You could not go into the temple until the following day and after you'd gone through a cleansing procedure. They were shocked when Jesus touched the coffin. So they stopped. They just stood still. And Jesus spoke to the young man who was lying there, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Now Jesus talked to him as though he were still alive. And in the three cases where Jesus raised the dead, he talked to the dead as though they were alive. In a couple of chapters, we'll come to Jairus' daughter. He goes into the room and he says to her, "Little dear, arise." When he came to the tomb of Lazarus, he cried, "Lazarus, come forth." Someone said it was good. He said, "Lazarus, come forth," or the whole graveyard would have been emptied had he just said, "Come forth." He talked to the dead as though they were alive. Why? Because the spirit of man doesn't die. The consciousness of man doesn't die. Only the body that experiences death. They are still alive. Jesus said, "If you live and believe in me, you'll never die." And so that is why Jesus spoke to the dead as though they were still alive, because man's body is the only thing that dies. The consciousness doesn't die. Jesus tells us in the 16th chapter of Luke, and we'll get to there in a few weeks, that in hell, the rich man lifted up his eyes, being in torment, seeing Lazarus afar off, being comforted in Abraham's bosom, cried and said, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus that he might take his finger, dip it in water, touch my tongue, for I am tormented in this heat." The consciousness was not dead. Remember that. The consciousness does not die. The body dies. In an interesting way, by some mysterious process, our our soul and spirit leaves our body, is freed from the body. The moment your soul leaves your body dies. It begins that process of decay. Doesn't take long. Lazarus was only 4 days dead, and when Jesus said, roll back the stone, they said, oh no, we can't do that, he stinks. The process of decay had already begun. Once your consciousness leaves your body, the body begins to decay immediately, begins to return back to the dust. But there's some mysterious way by which the life, the consciousness, keeps the body going. If you're in a terminal state, lying there in the hospital, they'll connect the EEG probes to your body. They'll watch the monitor to see the brain activity. When the thing goes flat, though the oxygen may be keeping your lungs working and there may be still a faint murmur of the heart, when the line goes flat, they know that you're dead. They watch it for 24 hours. And then they'll pull the plug and watch the monitor to see if, now that the oxygen is being deprived, if your mind is somehow grasping, to see if there's any flutter. And when the thing just stays flat, they say, he's dead. Clinically, you're dead. There is no consciousness. Some mysterious way, the consciousness has left the body, but the conscience hasn't quit. It isn't dead. Son, remember that you in your lifetime, Abraham said. He had his memory intact. He remembered his brother. He said, hey, if you can't help me, then send Lazarus back to help my brother. Memory was intact. Consciousness was intact. That is why Jesus talked to the dead as though they were not dead, because he was talking to the real person, the spirit, the consciousness of that person. When Jesus said, young man, I say to you, arise. He who was dead sat up and he began to speak, and Jesus brought him over to his mother, presented him to his mother. And a fear came upon the people, and they glorified God, and they said, a great prophet has risen among us. God has visited his people. And this report, the report of the raising of the dead, the widow's son, spread all over like wildfire. Clear on down into Judea, the area around Jerusalem, the religious center, but up through the upper Galilee regions too. In fact, the news spread even into Herod's prison, where John the Baptist was languishing away, because John dared to speak out against Herod's marital state, the way that he was living. And because he dared to speak out against Herod, he had him put into prison. But there in the prison, word came to John the Baptist, he's actually even raising the dead. So John, we read, called two of his disciples to him, and he sent them to Jesus with a question. Are you the coming one, or shall we look for another? So when the men had come to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you asking, are you the coming one, or shall we look for another? John could not understand the ministry of Jesus. He was perplexed. He is hearing how that Jesus is going around preaching to the poor. Jesus is healing the sick. Now he's raising the dead. When John was prophesying of the coming of Jesus, he said, there's one who is coming after me. He's mightier than I am. I'm not worthy to untie his shoelaces, his sandal straps. He's going to baptize you with the Holy Ghost with fire, and his fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly thresh the floor. He's going to clean things up. He's going to bring judgment, and boy, he's going to really come down hard, and things will be cleaned up once he comes. Jesus isn't going around in judgment. He's not cleaning things up like John expected him to. And so John is troubled. Are you really the Messiah? Are you the one? Or shall we start looking for someone else? Another way of saying, when are you going to get this show on the road? Because so many of the prophecies concerning the Messiah dealt with judgment. In fact, in Malachi chapter 3, which Jesus quotes concerning John the Baptist, as he said, "What, did you go out to see a prophet? Yes, I say unto you, more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way before you." Let's go back to Malachi 3 and read on beyond verse 1 and see what it says here concerning the one that was to come. "Behold, I send my messenger, he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord who you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire. He is like a fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. He will purify the sons of Levi, purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer to the Lord an offering in righteousness." And so he speaks about Jesus cleansing things, cleaning things up. So John is saying, hey, are you the one that we're looking for, or shall we start looking for someone else? When are you going to start cleaning things up? And when are you going to get me out of this prison? When are you going to take care of Herod and the Roman Empire? When are you going to exercise your authority sitting on the throne of David and the world coming in subjection unto you? John was probably getting tired of prison life. He surely wasn't a man made for that. He was a man of the wilderness. He was an outdoors man. I imagine being confined in a prison cell was actually a fate worse than death for a man who loves the outdoors. And John was the man of the outdoors, ruddy, rough, and rugged. Now he's been confined for a while in Herod's prison, and surely the Lord ought to get the show on the road. He ought to start throwing out Herod and the rest of the Roman powers, and he ought to establish God's kingdom and get me out of here. Are you the one that's coming, or shall we start looking for someone else? It's in a way a mild rebuke of Jesus for his delay in bringing judgment to establish the kingdom. You see, the problem that existed is that as you read the prophecies concerning the Messiah in the Old Testament, they almost seem to be contradictory. Isaiah speaks of the suffering servant, chapters 52 and 53. David speaks of the crucifixion. Yet Isaiah also speaks that his name shall be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end, for he will sit upon the throne of David and order it and establish it in righteousness and in judgment from now on forevermore. And the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And David also spake of the glory of the kingdom. And so you have almost conflicting prophecies concerning the Messiah. One of his suffering, despised, rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, dying a horrible death with transgressors, numbered with the transgressors in his death. And the others of his reigning forever in glory and power and majesty. Now, what they had done is they took all of the prophecies that related to the Messiah's being rejected, suffering, being a servant, and they spiritualized those prophecies. And they only took as literal those prophecies that spoke of the glory and the power of his kingdom that he would establish. And that is why they totally failed to recognize him when he came. Even though Zechariah had said, "Behold, your king comes to you, but he is lowly. He is sitting on a donkey." You know, don't look for him to come riding in on some chariot with tremendous armies and throwing out the Roman Empire. Watch for him coming in on a donkey. But they spiritualized that. It is interesting when Jesus came to the synagogue in Nazareth at the beginning of his ministry and they handed him the scriptures to read. And he opened to the passage in Isaiah 61. "Behold, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the meek, to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim the glorious day of the Lord, to bind up, to set free the captive, open the prison doors to those that are bound." You remember when Jesus read it and proclaimed the acceptable year of the Lord, he closed the book. He didn't read further on, the next verse, to bring judgment and all, because Jesus knew that his first coming was not to judge the world. He told Nicodemus, "Hey, I didn't come to judge, to condemn. The world is already condemned. I came to save. God didn't send me to condemn the world, but through me the world might be saved. And he that believeth is not condemned. He that doesn't believe is already condemned. I didn't come to condemn. They're already condemned. And this is the condemnation, that light came into the world, but men wouldn't come to the light, because they loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil." So Jesus understood the two aspects of his coming, but nobody else did. Even his own disciples, he tried to tell them, "I'm going to be betrayed, turned over to the rulers, they're going to crucify me." And Peter began to rebuke him and said, "Lord, be that far from you. Let's not hear any more of that, Jesus. I don't want to hear any more of that talk." They didn't understand, and Jesus tried to tell them over and over again. He said, "On the third day I'll rise again," but they didn't hear that. They were so shocked when he said, "I'm going to be crucified," they didn't hear anything else. Their minds just turned off at that point. They heard nothing else. He said, "But I'm going to rise the third day." They didn't even remember that until after he rose. They said, "Oh yeah, remember he said he was going to rise. Well, you know." Are you the one? Or shall we look for another? Note, when John had questions, he brought them directly to Jesus. He didn't go to his friends and say, "You know, I'm upset about this guy. You know, when's he going to get things going? How long before he really gets some action here, you know? Do you suppose he really is the one, or is there someone else? You know, is this really it?" He didn't take it to others. So often when we take our questions to others, it only genders strife. The best place to take your questions is right to the Lord. Come right to him. "Lord, You know, I don't understand this. I don't understand your methods. I don't understand what you're doing. I don't understand why you're not really coming down and judging and thoroughly cleansing the floor. Purging. Nor did he just harbor them in his mind. You know, a lot of times with your questions, if you just sort of sit on them and mull on them in your mind, they'll develop resentment. Because as you mull on them in your mind, you can come to all kinds of false conclusions. And it's a dangerous thing to just, you know, brood on your questions. It's a good way to develop doubt. Just brood on your questions. Well, I really don't know. Man, it doesn't seem to me, you know. I wonder if I've been conned the whole while. You know, you begin to feel resentful. If you have a question, if you have a problem with God, with the methods of God, bring them to God. I think you need to be honest with God. God, I'm having a problem here. I don't understand, Lord. What's going on? Why are you doing this? Or why haven't you done that? I think you ought to be honest and bring your questions to God. Now, it's interesting to me that Jesus didn't give the disciples of John a direct answer. In fact, it doesn't really say that at this point he answered them at all. But it's said, in that very hour, they asked the question, in the next hour, Jesus remained busy at the things he was doing, for he cured many people of their infirmities or sicknesses, of their afflictions, from evil spirits, and to many who were blind, he gave sight. So here these guys come with this burning question from John. Are you the one? Or shall we start looking for another? And rather than answering them directly, he just ministered to the needy people that were around him, curing their infirmities, their afflictions, driving out the evil spirits, and many, many blind people, their eyes were opened. Then Jesus answered, after about an hour of doing all these things, then Jesus answered and said, go and tell John the things that you have seen and heard. Jesus actually was calling his works to bear witness of who he was. Now, Nicodemus came to him by night and he said, now, we know that you are a teacher come from God because no man can do these works that you do. We know that you're a teacher come from God. Your works testify of that. Later on in the Gospel of John, Jesus said, I have a greater witness than that of John. John had borne witness of him. He said, I have a greater witness than that of John. For the works which the Father has given me to finish, the same works that I do, they bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. In the 14th chapter of John, Jesus said, believe that I am in the Father and the Father that is in me. The works that I do, I don't do of myself, but the Father that dwelleth in me, he does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father, or else believe for the very works' sake. In other words, his works were a witness as to who he was. So that the interesting thing to me is that rather than answering the question of John, Jesus just revealed himself. So often, our questions are answered by a further revelation of Himself. I come to Jesus with questions, honest questions. And rather than answering me directly, so often, He'll just reveal Himself to me more completely. Paul came. He had a thorn in the flesh. It was troubling him. He was seeking to get rid of it. The Lord did not answer Paul directly concerning that thorn in the flesh. He just revealed Himself to Paul and He said, "Hey, Paul, My grace is sufficient for you." Just the revelation of His grace. That's all you need, Paul. And so many times those burning questions of our hearts are answered by a further revelation of His glory and of His power. Doesn't matter. He's Lord. His works attest to it. So He just said, "Go back and tell John the things that you have seen and heard. How that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." Now, John knows the scriptures. He knows Isaiah 35, where Isaiah, in prophesying of the coming day of the Lord, that the dumb will be singing praises, the blind will behold the glory of God, and the lame will be leaping like deer. Back to Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor." Here it's happening. The gospel is being preached to the poor. The eyes are being opened. He's healing the brokenhearted, proclaiming liberty to the captives, the opening of the prison to those that are bound. And then Jesus said, "Blessed is he who is not offended because of me." Now, the intimation is that John was sort of offended because of him. The word offended there in the Greek is scandalizo. We have in Paul's letter to the Corinthians the root word being used in another case where Paul said, "But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a scandalon, a stumbling stone." They're stumbling over it. "Blessed is the man who doesn't stumble over me," Jesus said. "Blessed is the man who isn't offended because of me." Jesus, when he was with his disciples the night that he was betrayed, turning to them, the close inner circle, he said, "All of you are going to be offended this night because of me." I guess he was talking to the 11 because Judas had already taken off at this point. "All of you are going to be offended." Use the same word, scandalizo. And Peter said, "Lord, though these guys may all be offended, I'll never be offended." Scandalizo. "I won't be stumbled." She said, "Oh, Peter, before the cock crows, you will have denied me three times." "Lord, how can you say such a thing? I'll die for you." They were stumbled at the fact, always, that Jesus didn't use the power that they knew he had. that is often a stumbling stone for us. The disciples knew that Jesus had the power to avoid the cross. When Peter pulled his sword and began to swing, and Jesus said, "Peter, put away your sword." "Don't you realize, Peter, I have the power to call 10 legions of angels if I want." The fact that Jesus had the power to do it and didn't use the power was the thing that always stumbled them. John, that was the problem with John. He knew that Jesus had the power to overthrow the Roman government. He had the power to set up the kingdom. He had the power to get me out of jail. Why aren't you using your power to do the things I want you to do? Why do you use that power opening up the blind eyes and healing the sick and doing those things? Use your power to overthrow Rome. You're not using your power like I want to see you use your power. And you know, it is a problem to me oftentimes when I'm in a scrape and I'm asking the Lord's help and I know He has the power to help me and He doesn't. I get offended. It's a place of stumbling, isn't it? Because I know that the Lord has the power to heal, to deliver, to help. But when He doesn't use His power like I want Him to, like I would like to see Him use it, it oftentimes is a cause of offense. I get offended. I'm stumbled because He's not using His power like I think He ought to be using His power. That was John's problem. Now Jesus said, "Blessed is the man who isn't stumbled because of me, doesn't get offended because of me." John was offended. Jesus is not using His power as He ought. The disciples were offended because Jesus didn't use His power that they knew He had. He didn't just, you know, say Shazam and wipe out all of the priesthood and everything else, you know. And they knew that He had the power and He didn't use it. He submitted to the cross. He died on the cross. That offended them. When the priest said, "If He's really the Son of God, let Him come down now from the cross and we'll all believe Him." I'm sure Peter said, "All right, Lord, now's the time. Do it, do it, do it. Show Him." But He submitted to death, and that was a problem. They were stumbled. They were offended by that because He didn't use His power like they wanted Him to or expected Him to. Jesus didn't explain Himself, He just revealed Himself. I like that. Many times in our trials, we cry for understanding and Jesus doesn't explain it. He just reveals Himself as the all-sufficient one. Now, when the disciples of John left, He turned to the multitude and He started to speak to them concerning John. And He first asked the question three times, "What did you go out into the wilderness to see?" Most of them had gone out into the wilderness to see John the Baptist. He was down in a wilderness area by the Jordan River down towards Jericho. "What did you go out to see? Why did you go out there? Did you want to just see reeds shaking in the wind?" Along the Jordan, there grow all of these reeds. Jesus said, "Did you go out there to just watch the reeds blowing in the wind?" "No, you didn't go out to see that." What did you go out to see? A man dressed in gorgeous apparel? Some city dude all slicked up? He said, those fellows who wear gorgeous apparel, in rather a sarcastic way, he said, they dwell in king's palaces, not in king's prisons. And John was in the king's prison. Who did you go out to see? What did you go out to see? Some fellow dressed up in fancy apparel? Hey, no, those guys that dress in that kind of apparel, they're in the king's palaces. John was just wearing a coat of camel skin, rugged, rough, and ruddy fellow. What did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes. And I say unto you, more than a prophet. Now, we get the testimony of Jesus concerning John the Baptist. And with this testimony of Jesus concerning John the Baptist, as we put it together with the companion passages in Matthew's gospel, we see that it raises a lot of questions. Questions as to the identity of John the Baptist. Questions to the relationship of John the Baptist to Elijah the prophet. And these questions are legitimate and they deserve some attention on our part, more so than what we can give to them tonight. And therefore, tune in next week, same time, same station. We are on the air. Hi out there in Radio Land. But next week, we'll take the testimony of Jesus concerning John the Baptist, and we will try to clear up this confusion as to his identity with Elijah, where Jesus says he is, and John says he isn't. And so there is a seeming disparity between the declarations of Jesus and the declarations of John himself concerning who he is. And we'll try to address that issue next Thursday night as we continue our study through the Gospel of Luke, the testimony of Jesus concerning John. Shall we stand? Tonight at the close, which we are there, in the fellowship hall, we'll be having an afterglow for you who would like to just spend some time waiting upon the Lord this evening. If you need special prayer, if you need healing or help, there are those who will be over there who will be happy to pray for you and to minister to your needs tonight. So we encourage you to go over and wait upon the Lord and spend some time just waiting upon God with those in the fellowship hall. Man, that was a fantastic bubble. I've never seen one that big. Don't forget, special discount on the tickets in the office, and sign up if you would like to minister as a counselor during the showing of this Cry from the Mountain. You'll find it a very spiritually rewarding experience to lead someone to Jesus Christ. So may the Lord be with you and bless and keep you in his love, fill you with his Spirit, watch over and cause you to abound in all things in Christ. And may the Lord minister to those issues of your life where you find yourself offended with him. Blessed is the man, Jesus said, who is not offended because of me. He hasn't done the things you were hoping or wanting him to do. He didn't exercise that power like you were desiring him. Don't be offended. He's got his reasons. And you'll find that if you'll come to him with the questions, he will give to you a revelation of himself. He may not explain the situation, but he'll reveal himself, and you'll find that will be enough. The revelation of himself is always sufficient to see me through whatever situation I might be facing. That's what I need, more of him, the understanding and the knowledge of his grace, his love towards me. God be with you. Bless you in Jesus' name.